The Anger of Achilles. The BBC presents an epic for radio in three parts by Robert Graves. The Anger of Achilles, Part 3.
2,600 years ago, in a royal courtyard in Greece, an audience relaxing with wine cups at their elbows sat waiting for one of Homer's storytelling sons.
Wine for noble Phemias, the son of glorious Homer. Fill his agate cup to overflowing.
I thank you, noble king, shepherd of your people.
Your good health, son of blind Homer, to whom the muse has given inward sight.
And Apollo's blessing on this hospitable city.
Sing, Phemias, sing!
Sing the anger of Achilles.
Pray silence, lord, ladies, freemen, children, slaves. Honor Apollo and his noble servant, the bard Phemias, as he sings to the gods turtle shell lyre.
On this, my last night at your splendid court, most gracious king, I will end my tale from the 10th year of the long Trojan War, when 600 years ago, Prince Paris, aided by the love goddess Aphrodite, stole Menelaus's wife, Queen Helen of Sparta, and Priam, king of Troy, refused to send her back. I sing again of young Prince Achilles, who had brought his myrmidons to fight against the Trojans. He had now quarreled with the high king, Agamemnon of Mycenae, the Greek commander-in-chief, and withdrawn his forces from battle, nursing bitter anger against the high king, who had abducted his slim-waisted slave girl, Briseis. I sang before of Achilles' anger and of its implacability. Tonight, if the muse will favor me, I will tell how Achilles' anger was assuaged. A sorrowful and bloody tale. The triumphant Trojans, now sworn to capture the Greek fleet, advance like a storm or a forest fire, rank upon rank, their helmets glittering. Prince Hector of Troy led them, covered by his huge, round, bronze-plated bull's hide shield, and his tall helmet plume nodded as he went. When Hector bade them charge, his troops raised a war cry, but the Greeks stood fast, yelling defiance. The combined roar rose to high Olympus, where Father Zeus holds splendid court. It was also clearly heard by old King Nestor of Pylos, as he sat drinking cheese-flavored Pramnian wine with the chief surgeon of the Greeks, Machaon, son of Asclepius, and himself wounded in battle.
What are we to do, noble Machaon? The din grows louder. I must make a tour of inspection. I will take this shield and that stout, keen-bladed spear. But stay here, good Machaon, and drink until my slave girl, Hecamede, has heated water and washed the clotted blood from your wound.
Outside, a shameful sight confronted King Nestor. The Trojans were over the rampart, pursuing a mob of terrified Greeks. He paused uncertainly. Should he rally his comrades? Then he saw three wounded, dismal kings hobbling forward to view the battle, leaning heavily on their spears. Young Diomedes, once triumphant king of Argos, crafty Odysseus, king of Ithaca, subdued for once, and now no less a personage than the high king Agamemnon himself.
Why, venerable Nestor, what is this? Have you deserted your subjects?
Oh, my lord, Agamemnon. Are you wounded, too?
Shield arm near the elbow.
Zeus must surely have turned against us. As you see, the rampart is overrun. Our troops scurry about in all directions. I suggest that we avoid battle ourselves.
Yes.
For what can wounded men do? Hold a council at once to consider means of saving the day.
You are right, friend Nestor. Almighty Zeus seems determined upon our ruin. Ah, here is Odysseus.
Speared in the leg.
And beside him, Diomedes.
Pierced in the foot.
All of us forced to nurse our painful wounds. Now, this is my advice. Let us at once embark in the first line of ships, those at the water's edge, and then anchor until nightfall at a safe distance from the shore.
Good.
Later, if the Trojans retire, though even darkness may not check them, we might perhaps launch the second line.
Agamemnon! What do I hear?
Surely, Odysseus, we need not apologize for evading disaster, especially by night. The quicker you run, the longer you live.
Oh, cowardly wretch. Fit only to command our rabble, not the good soldiers whom Zeus has worse luck allowed you to waste in a succession of disastrous campaigns. Do you really intend to raise the siege after so many years of struggle and suffering? Once the troops get wind of your proposal, they'll break off the fight and rush panic-stricken down to the shore. A catastrophe for which, my lord Agamemnon, you alone will be responsible.
Oh, upon my word, Odysseus, I was not thinking of an evacuation against the army's wishes. In fact, I'm quite ready to accept more bellicose counsel. Yeah, but what does King Diomedes think? You stood silent all this while, you whom we call Diomedes of the loud war cry.
My lord Agamemnon, if you can accept advice without resentment, for I am the youngest man present, I believe that, wounded though we be, it is our duty to appear on the battlefield. And though we must stay out of spear range lest we be wounded a second time, we can at least spur forward those of our comrades who have hitherto kept in the rear.
I cordially agree.
Forward, then, I'll lead the way.
Standing on a spur of many peaked Olympus, Hera, mother of the gods, gazed down at the naval camp and was delighted to see her brother, the sea god Poseidon, disguised as the prophet Calchas, busily rallying her beloved Greeks. But a glance at Mount Ida told her that Zeus was still seated there, determined to let the Trojans win the day.
Oh, how I loathe my tyrannical husband. If only I could make him change his mind. Why not visit Mount Ida, ravishingly dressed, and make him conceive a sudden passionate desire for me? Then, when I have lured him into bed, I will persuade Morpheus, god of sleep, to settle on his eyelids and fog his sharp wits while Poseidon leads my Greeks to victory. Yes, this can be contrived, I believe.
So saying, the goddess Hera retired to her gilded boudoir, shot the bolt, and took off all her clothes.
Now, first I use this ambrosial lotion to remove every stain or smutch from my delicious body. Next, I rub this ambrosial oil into my skin, a wonderful ungent, so penetratingly fragrant that I have merely to unstopper this flask anywhere in the palace for its scent to spread through heaven and the entire earth. Now a little of this same oil on my hair. Comb it well in. Plait these long, shining tresses. And a fresh linen robe, the one woven for me by industrious Athene.
So saying, the goddess Hera pinned a number of handsome jewels on the robe and fastened it across her breast with golden clasps. Then she hooked a lucent 3-drop earring into each lobe to make herself look even lovelier, and finally draped a splendid new veil bright as the sun over head and shoulders. And nor did she forget a beautiful pair of sandals. Well satisfied with her appearance, Hera called quietly to the love goddess Aphrodite.
Aphrodite. Dear child, you won't surely deny me a favor just because you support the Trojans in this war and I the Greeks.
No, certainly not, Queen Hera. Tell me your needs, and unless the favor is beyond my power, I shall be charmed to grant it.
Well, could you possibly lend me your magical girdle?
My girdle? The fact is, I'm visiting my ancient uncle and aunt, King Oceanus and Queen Tethys, who brought me up in their distant palace when I was virtually left an orphan. I want to end that stale old quarrel of theirs. They have not slept in the same bed for ages. If I can only reconcile them and arrange a second honeymoon, they will forever hold me in the greatest affection.
So, without hesitation, Aphrodite unfastened the exquisite embroidered girdle which housed her enchantments, namely, love and love longing and love talk, magical powers that fool even the keenest intelligence.
To refuse you this little thing, Queen Hera, would show disrespect to your husband, Father Zeus. Here, take this girdle. Hide it in a fold of your robe, and your mission can hardly fail.
Hera smiled triumphantly and flew eastward over the rough Aegean Sea. At the island of Lemnos, she went in search of Morpheus, god of sleep, and took him by the hand.
Sweet Morpheus, please help me, and I shall be eternally in your debt.
Tell me more, Queen Hera.
Soon, when Zeus and I have performed the act of love, I want you to settle on his shining eyes and softly close their lids. If you do that for me, I will ask my son, the smith god Hephaestus, to forge you an imperishable golden throne with a magnificent footstool for festive use.
Divine Mother of the gods, I can easily make other immortals drowse off, but I dare not serve Father Zeus thus, unless I have his express sanction.
Oh, but
you may remember I found myself in trouble a couple of generations ago after doing you this very favor.
Did you?
Yes. When I took advantage on that occasion of Zeus's soporific state, you let loose a great tempest and drove his son Heracles' ship far off course.
Oh, yes.
Then Father Zeus awoke and in dreadful anger began to toss all Olympians out of his palace trying to catch me. I would have been hurled down from the bright upper air to perish in the pit of hell had it not been for dear Mother Night, with whom I took hurried refuge. And you ask me to risk my life a second time? I must regretfully decline.
Morpheus, your qualms are foolish. Grant me this favor, and I will marry you to the youngest and prettiest of the three graces.
To Passiea?
Yes.
Oh.
And you've long been in love with her.
Very well.
Ah.
Under cover of a thick mist, Queen Hera and the god of sleep flew together to Mount Ida, where he perched on a pine tree in the shape of a nightjar, while Hera, now wearing Aphrodite's girdle, went on alone. As soon as Zeus saw her, the most passionate desire seized him. It was exactly like that delightful occasion centuries before when, unknown to their kind-hearted parents, these two first committed incest together. But Father Zeus was puzzled by Hera's unexpected visit.
Dear wife, what brings you here? Where did you leave your chariot for the steep return journey?
Dearest husband, my mind is set on patching up that quarrel between our ancient uncle and aunt, King Oceanus and Queen Tethys.
Oh.
I thought you might have been annoyed if I'd gone without an explanation.
Hmm.
I have left my chariot team tethered at the foot of this mountain.
Oh, darling Hera, surely another day will do as well. Let us make love at once. Never in my entire life have I felt such intense longing for goddess or nymph as I feel for you this afternoon. Why, my interest in Danae, the girl with the beautiful ankles, on whom I begot the hero Perseus, was nothing at all by comparison.
What? I should certainly hope not.
And the same applies to the celebrated Europa, on whom I begot Minos and his brother Rhadamanthus, the judges of the dead.
That cow-eyed trollop.
Indeed, it equally supplies to Semele, on whom I begot the universally adored Dionysus, and to Alcmene of Thebes, on whom I begot bold Heracles.
Infidelity after infidelity, you glory in them.
And to our own sister, Demeter, the goddess with the beautiful locks, on whom I begot Persephone, and to the famous Leto, on whom I begot Apollo and Artemis. Why, I would venture to say, dearest wife, that I have never yet conceived so delirious a passion, even for yourself. Come into my arms at once.
Revered son of Cronus, what a shocking idea. Do you mean us to make love up here in full sight of all Olympus?
Yes.
Suppose some god were to play spy and tell the other immortals what he'd seen. I should never have the face to go home after that. It would certainly give me a pardonable grievance against you. However, if I must humor you in this inconvenient fashion, pray take me to the Olympian bedchamber which our son Hephaestus made for us. We can be private there.
No, no, darling Hera. Have no fear that either god or man will witness our marital sport. I shall spread an immense golden cloud over us, which even the brightest eye in existence, the sun's, will fail to pierce.
Almighty Zeus then caught hold of Hera, laid her down masterfully, and took his pleasure of her. The earth beneath them was divinely induced to sprout a soft, thick carpet of fresh grass, tender clover, crocuses and hyacinth flowers that raised the lovers a hand's breadth into the air. So they embraced on the crest of Gargarus, covered by a golden cloud from which cool, sparkling dew dripped upon their naked bodies, until Zeus dozed off, conquered by the arts of love and sweet waters.
Now to accomplish Hera's plan.
Then Morpheus hurried towards the Greek camp, where he sought out the sea god Poseidon.
Greetings, Poseidon. You always stir your sea to a turmoil, but now the coast is clear at last. Hera has tricked Zeus into pleasuring her, and I have lulled him to sleep. Go, help the Greeks as much as you wish. Let them enjoy the hour of glory.
I thank you heartily, god of sleep.
Greeks! Follow me now. Collect the broadest shields and the toughest spears in camp. Put on your glittering helmets and form up behind me. Hector of Troy will not long withstand us.
Despite their aching wounds, the three kings, Agamemnon, Diomedes, and Odysseus, rearmed and offered their services to Poseidon, the Earthshaker. For no longer disguised as the prophet Calchas, he now wielded that terrible, keen-edged sword of his, which resembles a lightning flash and which no mortal dares face in battle. A sea wave came hissing among the Greek ships and huts, and at this signal, they advanced with a resonant shout. Seas that break against the bill, when winds blow northeasterly, fire that sweeps a wooded hill, gales that howl in bush or tree. None such ever raised so dreadful a din as the roar of battle that went up when the Trojan and Greek armies clashed once more. Hector of Troy hurled his spear at great Ajax's exposed breast and struck it at the point where shield baldric and sword baldric cross. The blade turned without penetrating the corslet. Then suddenly a rock flew over the rim of Hector's shield and caught him below the neck. Ajax had picked up and thrown one of the many large boulders, chocks for beached vessels, now rolling among the fighter's feet. It spun Hector of Troy around like a peg top. He clattered to the dust. Once the Greeks rushed up, trying to drag Hector away, but the bravest Trojans in the field carried him moaning to his chariot and drove off towards Troy. At this moment, Zeus, father of gods and men, awoke on the peak of Gargarus. He disengaged himself from Hera's arms, leapt to his feet, and turned towards Troy. There he saw a column of Greek champions led by the sea god Poseidon, driving before them a mob of frightened fugitives, while at a ford of the deep Scamander River, a group of Trojans crouched in tears around the moribund Hector.
O hero, with what crooked art you meddle in this fight. Prince Hector bleeds beside the ford. His men are turned to flight. Beware, lest now I take revenge, my lovely queen, on you. Thrashing your exquisite white skin till it turned black and blue. Once long ago, I trussed you up. I trussed you up so neat. With golden gyves about your wrists and anvils on your feet. Hanging you from the cloudy pole for all the world to see. The immortal gods were mad with rage, but could not set you free. The ugly story, I repeat, false wife, to rouse your fears, that this new treasonable trick may end in floods of tears.
Dear Lord, I swear by earth and heaven, by the tumbling waters of Styx, by your own sacred head and by our marriage bed to which I have always remained faithful, that Poseidon did not take the field against the Trojans at my suggestion. He gave way to a sudden impulse of pity for the hard-pressed Greeks. Had he consulted me, I should, of course, have advised him to leave well alone.
Poseidon, get back to your watery domain.
So Zeus, having ordered Poseidon back to his underwater palace, and he reluctantly obeyed, sent the god Phoebus Apollo to revive Hector. And the Greeks, still pursuing Trojans with swords and spears, suddenly became aware that Hector of Troy had taken the field again. At once, every man's heart sank to his sandals. Hector's free-striding chariot team led the countercharge, and in front of him flew the god Apollo, his shoulders wrapped in cloud, carrying a bright, dreadful, shaggy-fringed shield, which reduced the Greeks to impotence. Back into the Greek camp surged the Trojans over a firm, broad bridge, which Apollo had improvised from the broken parapet. A little boy laughing for glee builds castles by the summer sea, then exercises foot and hand to scatter them in clouds of sand. So with equal ease and merriment, Apollo kicked down an ample length of rampart and drove the panic-stricken Greeks back to their ships.
Achilles! Achilles! Dear Achilles!
Why come whining to me, my dear Patroclus, like a disappointed little girl to her mother? Is it because Agamemnon, the High King of the Greeks, is at last being punished for his ingratitude to me? Out with the truth.
Achilles, the three kings, Agamemnon, Odysseus, Diomedes, even our surgeon Machaon, are all severely wounded. Oh, how can I make you relent?
You cannot.
What thanks will future generations give you if your greatest fame rests on a refusal to intervene while their fathers are being massacred? Achilles, let me lead your myrmidons against the enemy. Place them under my orders, dear comrade, and lend me your armor. When the Trojans see your helmet crest, they are sure to mistake me for you, and then a sudden charge by our fresh troops should drive them from our camp.
Oh, Patroclus, how you run on. This black mood of mine, as you well know, is due solely to my having been robbed by King Agamemnon. In carrying off Briseis, my slave girl, my prize of honor, captured by me, he treated me like a camp follower. Yet no man, I suppose, can stay angry forever. You were right. I saw Agamemnon and Diomedes leaving the field. Odysseus and our surgeon, Machaon, too. Now I hear only Hector's yells of encouragement to his Trojans. Very well. Take my famous armor and lead out my myrmidons.
Oh, my lord.
But listen to me. Once you have freed our camp of the enemy, go no further. For although Zeus the Thunderer may crown you with glory, it will hurt my honor if you yield to ambition and take too much on yourself. Come back as soon as your main task is accomplished and leave the two armies battling on the plain. No! Patroclus! One of our ships is on fire!
Oh, my lord.
You must intervene at once and guard our flotilla if we are ever to return. Take my armor, buckle it on, then yoke and harness my team of horses, Windswift, Xanthus, and Valius. But first, call the Myrmidons to arms.
wasps that build their fragile nest by the track may prove a pest. If a careless passerby treads too near it, out they fly, buzzing loud with fortitude in defense of their young brood. Still more strident are their tones when small boys come flinging stones. Then in fury wasps attack all who venture up the track.
Forward, like angry wasps, myrmidons! Show what you can do! Teach the High King Agamemnon how blind he was to dishonor our great commander, Achilles, the finest fighter in this army, as you were its finest contingent!
The Myrmidons did all and more than Prince Patroclus asked of them. They not only saved the ships, but drove the Trojans out of the camp headlong, and this time for good. Father Zeus, however, who can fool any mortal, encouraged Patroclus to exploit his victory. After inflicting immense losses on the Trojans, he forgot Achilles' orders, mounted the chariot, lashed Xanthus and Balius to a gallop, and tried to capture Troy single-handed. Prince Patroclus met with divine chastisement for this presumption. Cloaked in mist, the god Apollo stepped behind Patroclus and with the edge of his hand struck him on the neck. The borrowed helmet flew off and rattled away in the dust. The borrowed spear shattered in his grasp, and Apollo unbuckled his corslet. As Patroclus stood, dazed, trembling, and at a loss, Hector of Troy darted forward and speared him low in the belly.
Patroclus! See how Achilles has deceived you. It is not armor alone that makes a hero.
Boast of your triumph, Hector, son of Priam. It was given you by Zeus and by Apollo. Otherwise, I could have dealt with a score of champions as strong as you. But be warned, Hector. I see death and fate hovering over your head. Achilles will avenge me.
Achilles knew nothing of Patroclus' fate, because the battle had been fought far away under the walls of Troy. But his horses, Xanthus and Balius, which had escaped from the fighting, stood weeping beside the river.
Staunch as a headstone on the tomb of man or woman dead, each creature stood oppressed by gloom in anguish at Patroclus' doom. Abasing his proud head, their golden manes once flaunted high above the yoke, drooped dismally upon the marshy ground.
But Father Zeus now took pity on Xanthus and Balius.
Poor immortal teammates, you were not meant to share man's sorrows. And upon my word, I can think of no more miserable creature that draws breath and crawls on the face of this earth than man. Still, I promise you one thing. Hector of Troy shall never mount Achilles' beautiful chariot and become your master.
So Xanthus and Balius raised their muzzles, shook the dust from their manes, and galloped away. While Achilles, watching the distant battle from the stern of his ship, wondered why the Greeks were streaming back.
My lord Achilles,
son of Nestor. Tell me the worst.
Alas, Prince Achilles, I am entrusted with a hateful message. We are bringing you Patroclus' naked corpse, despoiled by Hector the bright helm.
Patroclus! Dead!
Achilles scooped up handfuls of black ashes, which he poured over his head, rubbed on his face, and let fall on his tunic. Slave girls saw him tumble, groaning to the ground in an ecstasy of grief. They rushed from the hut and gathered about him, their knees trembling. The son of Nestor likewise lamented, but was careful to hold Achilles' hand for fear he might cut his own throat. Achilles' groans were so deep and dismal that his mother, the silver-footed sea goddess Thetis, heard them from afar off at the bottom of the sea. She swam through the salt waves and stepped ashore on the beach where Achilles' ships lay, gunwale to gunwale. There she knelt beside her recumbent son.
Why do you weep, child? Tell me what ails you.
Oh, mother. Patroclus, the friend whom I loved as myself, is dead. Today, Hector of Troy killed him. Here I sat, a useless encumbrance to the earth, while Hector slaughtered Patroclus. Still pleased to nurse my grudge against Agamemnon. It smoldered in my heart and was as sweet to me as trickling honey. But now I shall forget my injury and exact vengeance on Hector. The Trojans shall know to their cost that I am fighting once more. Mother, in your deep love, do not persuade me not to fight, or I shall stop my ears.
Dear child, who can blame you for rallying to the aid of your distressed comrades? Yet Hector is flaunting your own fine armor. Wait until tomorrow before challenging him. At sunrise, I promise to bring you a suit newly forged by none other than Hephaestus, the smith god.
These splendid arms are worthy of the divine giver.
Then up, my son, and take vengeance on your enemies.
I, Achilles, son of Peleus, summon all Greeks to the assembly ground.
My lord Agamemnon, our recent scandalous quarrel has profited us nothing. I heartily wish that my slave girl Briseis had died at the sack of Leonessus rather than cause the loss of so many of your noble comrades. I say, let us henceforth keep a close guard on our tongues. I am willing to forget my anger if you, my lord king, since your wounds keep you inactive, appoint me commander-in-chief of your army.
Heroic comrades, pray be courteous and listen to me in silence, as though I were standing, for my wound keeps me seated. Even a practiced orator finds it hard to ignore a buzz of interruptions. Nor can his audience hear what he is saying. I thank you. Now, I shall address Prince Achilles and call upon every man present to witness my words. Son of Peleus, others beside yourself have often deplored my ill-considered utterances. Yet Zeus, fate, and the fury who walks in darkness are more to blame than I. They fooled me by suggesting that I should demand a certain possession of yours. Pray show forgiveness. Are we mortals not always at the mercy of the immortals? I fully admit the error, though not the responsibility for what I have done, and eagerly desire to make you amends in the form of handsome damages. I ask no return, but that you will lead my army, a commission which you have anticipated. If, therefore, you care to wait while the gifts previously offered to you by King Odysseus are placed again at your disposal, I will keep my promise and issue the necessary orders.
My lord king, whether you keep your promise or not must be your own concern. I have set my heart on immediate battle. And subtle speculations about the divine authorship of our dispute do not interest me anymore.
My lord Achilles, nobody doubts your courage, but do not take hungry men into the field. Pray allow your comrades to breakfast first on meat and wine.
King Odysseus, how can you talk of breakfast when so many Greek corpses strew the plain? Corpses of your friends, whom Zeus helped Hector kill. I would have the army fight dry-throated and empty-bellied all day. And at nightfall, enjoy a huge feast in celebration of vengeance victoriously taken. Myself, I will touch neither food nor drink before then.
Nevertheless, my lord Achilles, since I am older and more experienced than you, listen to me. A breakfast interval will allow Agamemnon to produce his gifts for you to admire. I'm sure they will please you. Further, by way of perfect appeasement, the High King is prepared to swear that he has never slept with this slave girl, Briseis.
And thus it was, thanks to crafty Odysseus, that Achilles ordered the troops disperse for their breakfasts, while his myrmidons fetched from Agamemnon's treasure the exact indemnity promised. The 7 tripods, the 10 talents of gold, the 12 horses, the 20 shining new copper cauldrons, the 7 captive women, and lovely Briseis herself. Briseis at once flung herself on Patroclus' corpse and wailed loudly, tearing her breasts and neck and beautiful face.
Oh, generous Patroclus, my protector. When I left your hut, you were still alive. Alas, how I am dogged by misfortune. After Achilles had widowed me at the sack of Leonessus, he would often say, "Dry your eyes, Briseis, daughter of Minos. I will persuade him to marry you. Then we three shall sail off together and celebrate your wedding feast at Phthia." Oh, how my heart aches. No kinder man that Patroclus ever lived.
Soon battle was joined. How many bold Trojans Achilles killed that morning, it would weary me to tell and you to hear. But his weapons, armor, and chariot wheels were bathed in blood, while Father Zeus rumbled terribly from the sky. And his brother, the sea god Poseidon, shook plains and high mountains with a heavy earthquake. The spurs of many-fountained Mount Ida quivered, so did the citadel of Troy, and the Greek fleet rocked, though on dry land. Achilles continued his carnage, and old King Priam, posted on the watchtower, saw his terror-stricken Trojan subjects streaming towards him. With a shout of alarm, he descended to the battlements.
Sentries! Unbar both wings of the gate and keep them wide open to admit your hard-pressed comrades. When all are safely home, shut the gate again in the face of bloodthirsty Prince Achilles.
Parched and grimy, the Trojans came pelting along, harried by Achilles' great lance, and poured impetuously into the city as fast as their weary legs would take them. The Greek army followed with raised shields, finding no opponents still alive on the plain, except Hector the bright-helmed alone, whom destiny compelled to post himself in front of the gate.
Hector, sweet son, come inside, I implore you. Achilles is far stronger than you and knows no mercy. Beware, he is almost upon you.
Achilles runs up like a victorious racehorse, his divine armor blazing like the dog star at harvest time. He is almost upon Hector, brandishing the dreadful lance, when suddenly Hector pretended to be terrified of him and ran off, darting at great speed close under the walls, past Priam's watchtower. Then, along a wagon track towards 2 neighboring sources of the river Scamander, past the massive troughs used by Trojan housewives where they washed their fine linen in days of peace, the god Phoebus Apollo so strengthened Hector's lungs and legs that even swift-footed Achilles failed to overtake him. Hector hoped to reach the battlements covering the Dardanian gate, where his comrades would send a volley of spears at Achilles. But whenever he approached it, Achilles spurted, took the inside berth, and forced him out towards the plain. Three times they circled the walls of Troy, and when they came to the troughs on their fourth circuit, Zeus grasped his golden scales and laid a lot in each of the pans, one for Achilles, one for Hector, and poised them carefully. Hector's lot sank down, at which sign of doom, the god Phoebus Apollo abandoned him to his fate. The goddess Athene now appeared before Hector, having taken the shape of his brother, Prince Deiphobus, and pretending to have run out from the Dardanian gate. She hailed him in Deiphobus' voice.
Dear brother, this is I, Deiphobus. Come to your rescue. Stop, stand, and let us face Achilles together.
Deiphobus! Always the best of brothers to me, and never more welcome than now. So you alone dare to come to my aid.
Yes, brother. Let us now fight together like heroes. Call Achilles closer. See where he pauses, leaning on his lance.
Come within casting distance, Achilles. You and I must now fight it out. But first let us swear an oath that whichever by Zeus's leave kills and despoils the other will not dishonor the corpse, but convey it to his own people for burial.
Madman, dare you bargain with me? Now die, since no escape is left. I am promised victory by Pallas Athene and shall make you pay in full.
Poising his great lance, Achilles hurled at Hector.
Amiss! Has Pallas Athene perhaps deceived you? Now guard your head. May this spear cast free Troy of the worst terror that this long war has brought upon her.
Hector's hurtling spear struck the center of Achilles' shield, but rebounded harmlessly from the enchanted metal.
Quick, Deiphobus, my brother, lend me another spear. Deiphobus, Deiphobus, where are you? Oh, I understand. It was Athene disguised as my brother and betrayed. Yet I will not die without first performing a feat of arms fit to stir the hearts of all posterity. I have still my broadsword.
Hector, brandishing his sword, ran at Achilles. How was he to know that the goddess Athene had pulled Achilles' lance from the earth and restored it to his grasp? In an ecstasy of rage, Achilles leapt to the encounter, shield held high and golden plumes waving, drove his lance through Hector's bare throat and sent him crashing to the ground.
At last I am avenged for sweet Patroclus' death. At last I can give him a splendid funeral and fling his murderer to the dogs and kites.
Oh, Achilles, may all that you hold sacred spare my corpse. My father, King Priam, will ransom it, whatever the price.
Ransom? If King Priam came out himself with a pair of scales, eager to pay me the weight of your corpse in gold, I should laugh at him. No, nothing in the world can keep the carrion birds from tearing at your belly or the dogs from crunching your bones.
Dying men foresee the future, since I cannot melt that heart of iron. Know that my brother Paris will avenge me with an arrow piercing your one mortal spot, the heel of your right foot.
The shadow of death touched Hector, life ebbed away, and his ghost fled to the gloomy kingdom of Hades, bewailing his lost youth and pride. Achilles freed the lance and stooped to unbuckle Hector's blood-stained armor, setting himself to outrage the corpse. Having slit the tendon of each foot from heel to ankle, he looped a rawhide thong through the holes and bound both ends to his chariot tail. Then he mounted, flung the spoils of battle beside him, lashed his horses Xanthus and Balius to a gallop, and away they flew. Hector's corpse trailed after them, churning up the dust, his dark, flowing locks disheveled, and his once glorious features begrimed with filth of the battlefield. Such was the fate ordained for Hector by Almighty Zeus, to have his body desecrated in full sight of his fellow citizens. Queen Hecuba screamed, tore her hair, and cast away her bright veil. King Priam moaned piteously, and his subjects wept and howled as though Troy were tumbling in blackened ruins about them. And even Queen Helen, though every Trojan woman now eyed her with hatred, ventured on this heartbroken dirge.
Oh,
Hector's wife, Andromache, knew nothing of his death. No reliable message, even of his decision to stay outside the city walls, had reached her house. She sat at the loom, weaving a pattern of flowers into a wide purple cloth. Then, at the sound of the distant dirge, Andromache started, so violently that the shuttle fell to the floor. She rushed to the thronged battlements, her breast heaving. There she looked down, and all went black before her eyes. That evening, Achilles built Patroclus a tall pyre 100 feet square, upon which he and his myrmidons reverently placed the bier. Next, they slaughtered a whole flock of sheep and a herd of cattle. Achilles flayed the carcasses, stripped off the fat, swathed Patroclus in it from head to foot, and spread the flesh about him. He also leaned against the bier a row of two-handled jars full of oil and honey, sacrificed 4 gallant horses, groaning aloud as he did so, and lastly, 12 Trojan prisoners whom he had kept for this occasion, adding their bodies to the holocaust. Then he kindled the fire, and boisterous sea winds kept the flames roaring all night. Achilles tramped about the pyre, emptying on the earth a 2-handled goblet which he constantly replenished from a golden wine bowl, moaning, howling, and crying farewell to Patroclus' ghost.
Patroclus, hear my call, echoing through King Hades' hall, true to the promise that I made, 12 Trojans on your pyre are laid. But rest assured, I will not pay like honor to mad Hector's clay, in vengeance of his impious deed, the flames, the dogs shall on him.
They heaped a barrow over Patroclus' ashes, and funeral games were celebrated in his honor. But Achilles' grief remained unassuaged. Again and again he would rise from his couch at night to drag Hector's naked corpse, tied to his chariot tail, 3 times round the barrow. Then he would return, leaving it lying prone in the dust. But still he could not sleep.
Of his impious deed, no flames, but dogs shall on him feed.
Thetis, my beloved mother.
Dear son, this grief will be the death of you. Why not try food and rest? Even sleeping with a slave girl might be helpful. But here is a message from Zeus himself. He and his fellow gods are angered by your denial of Hector's corpse to the parents.
If Father Zeus commands me to surrender Hector's corpse, I shall obey. Though the ransom must be enormous!
Almighty Zeus sent Hermes, messenger of the gods, to King Priam. This was his message. Out, Priam, out to the Greek camp. Take splendid gifts in hand and seek Achilles where he lurks beside the salt sea strand. Yet ride alone, poor desolate king, save for a herald true.
drive a mule cart through the night and guide its team for you. Which cart two purposes shall serve? To heap those gifts upon and fetch away the ransomed corpse of Hector, your great son.
Achilles, I, King Priam, clasp your knees as a suppliant and implore mercy in the name of your father, King Peleus. Like me, he is old and stricken, yet sometimes news comes to him that you are alive and well. He grows cheerful again, thinking, one day my son Achilles will return. Alas, no such hope can sustain me. For my son Hector died at your spear point in the defense of Troy. And I have come with a load of treasure to ransom his body, Prince Achilles. For the sake of your father, show me compassion.
Wise, my lord king. Alas, how you must have suffered. Come, sit down quietly beside me.
But how can I sit at my ease while my son Hector's corpse lies unburied in your lines? Accept the huge ransom I have brought with me.
Venerable Priam, I had decided to restore Hector's corpse.
You...
Even before you came, I received a message from Zeus. And now I am convinced that some god must have led you to me. I will place your son's body under the tilt of your cart, and you may drive him home.
You are generous, Prince Achilles.
Tonight you shall eat in my hut.
So be it. I return to Troy at dawn. Make up a bed for me and let us court sweet sleep. I have not closed my eyes since you killed my son Hector.
My lord king, you would be well advised to spend the night outside my hut. If some counselor should come for a midnight conference, as often happens, and were to recognize you, he might inform our high king, Agamemnon, who would assuredly make trouble about the ransom.
Oh, yes.
But tell me, how many days will Hector's obsequies last? I undertake not to resume the battle while they are in progress.
An armistice, my lord Achilles, would be most welcome. Mourning will last 9 days. On the 10th, we burn the corpse and celebrate a funeral feast. On the 11th, we raise his barrow. On the 12th, we do battle. If you attack us...
Very well. With this clasp of hand and wrist, I pledge myself to keep the Greek army in camp until the 12th day. And now, my lord king, let us turn our thoughts to supper. Eat and gain strength to lament your beloved son as you carry him home to Troy.
Then they shared a succulent meal together. And when they had eaten and drunk enough, Priam and his herald lay down to sleep, but outside the hut. Inside, Achilles, acting on his mother's advice, took lovely Briseis to bed with him. My lord king, you have now heard the tale of Achilles' ruinous anger and of how it was assuaged. Dare I hope that it has pleased you? Go to bed, dear muse, take your rest, and good night to you all. That was the final part of The Anger of Achilles, an epic for radio by Robert Graves, from his translation of Homer's Iliad. Agamemnon was played by Morris Denham, Achilles by Robert Hardy, Odysseus by John Slater, Nestor by Norman Shelley, Hector by Gabriel Wolfe, and Zeus by Francis de Wolfe.
Phemius, son of Homer, a bard, was spoken and sung by Dennis Quilly. The music was specially composed by Roberto Gerard, and production for the BBC was by Raymond Rakes.